Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. Today I have a good friend of mine, it's Justin Gill. Rather than explain who Justin is, I'll let Justin introduce himself. How are you doing, brother? And welcome.
Great, thank you. Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you. It's a real pleasure to be with you and talking about things that God's doing around the country. I'm Justin Gill. I've served with FIEC as Intercultural Ministry Advisor alongside some technical stuff that I do. So it's a ministry that I really love and enjoy, and it came into place over the last 3 to 4 years to help churches who are becoming multicultural and wants to intentionally move towards becoming intercultural churches. So this ministry exists to help FIEC churches. And with kind of a gospel generosity, we help churches even outside FIEC. So that's what my role is currently. But I'm born and bred Pakistan, north of Pakistan. Came to the UK to study as an international student. And then stayed around and met my wife, Angela, who's white British English and half Scottish. And thanks to my mother-in-law. So she's just amazing wife, and we live in a village called Kibworth, and we call it Kibworth Porsche, just to be, to sound a bit posh.
Brilliant. So you said part of your role is technology, technical side of things, and the other part is intercultural director helping churches. So can you just explain a little bit about what does intercultural mean? Because I think for a lot of people who, especially in the north of England, whose churches for a long time have been very kind of homogenous, and there's been very little diversity in within the church, multicultural and intercultural. Some of these terms might be misunderstood or not even understood. So could you just share about what that means?
Of course. I was actually when I started this role and I was going through my archives, the first year of my university, University of Bradford, I did community regeneration and development. So understanding the changing nature of the British society as becoming more multicultural. And at that time, when I was looking at the society, at the same time, I started looking into the church as well. So I was at the time reading some literature, finding who in the church is thinking about that as churches are becoming multicultural, as well as myself coming from a different country. But there wasn't much at the time, and I'm talking about 2006, 7, and 8, and 9. So the only one that I could find, and in my archives, I went through my documents, and it was an affinity document, a table talk that I think you used to do in from spring 2007, issue 19, and it was on multicultural churches, and the title was The Possible Question Mark, Workable Question Mark, Desirable Question Mark. So that was the earliest kind of literature that I've come across so far that exists in the UK, somebody talking about multicultural churches. Now, at that time, it was like, okay, yeah, we are becoming multicultural. How should we perceive this? So that was initial discussion. So that was quite encouraging. Okay, somebody's thinking through. There were some examples in this document they talk about, and some encounters of different cultures coming together and their tensions between them. But then, since then, the things have progressed. And the term intercultural, there's nowhere we can pinpoint to where it's come from. I've read quite a bit and stuff, and everybody, the different countries, they talk about different types of things. So intercultural, in terms of the way as Western thinking has come through the Greek method of thinking or key Greek methodology, we like our definitions. I can't come to, I to be honest, I don't have a definition, right? So if you're looking for me, like you like want to have a definition. Sorry, for intercultural, I don't have a definition. But the best way to think, is not to have a definition. But I would say, let's think of the church, you know, if you think that your church is becoming multicultural in terms of different racial backgrounds or different races or cultures, in terms of different nations from around the world that are coming to your church. Now, let's be honest, our British church has been traditionally white middle class, right? And all of a sudden, in specifically in the last 10 years, I think this has changed. And now the notable factor has been the color. That's why people started thinking, oh, okay, there are differences, there are different cultures. But the cultural differences already existed in British society, but we didn't notice that till the color of people changed. So there were class differences. You know, as you know, they always existed, but we didn't make much notice of that. And we, like in the UK, we already have multiple nations. We got English, we got Welsh, we got Scottish, we got Irish. So the noticeable difference was just because the color changed a little, you know, in the church. So that's where we're starting putting more kind of emphasis. Okay, we are becoming multicultural. So the difference is that, yes, okay, God's bringing all these people in your church. You know, God is really at work. If you getting those different cultures coming in, God is really at work. So how do we serve the people who are coming in to our churches through the doors? How do we preach the gospel to them? Now, the truth of the gospel is the absolute truth that we hold, right? It doesn't mean that you have to change the absolute truth, but you have to proclaim the truth differently to different cultural context. That's the challenge. And that's where, like, the cross-cultural thinking becomes, or called cross-cultural intelligence becomes quite important. And it's not just I would say in the current context, it's not just that the white British have to adopt to other cultures. Every other culture in it has to adopt for other cultures. So we all have to kind of make adjustments. We have all have to think cross-culturally. So onus is not just on one culture. So these are the struggles that are there in a multicultural church. Now, how intentional we want to be, or the church leadership or the church wants to be, to become intercultural, to crossing that threshold, what does it mean? So it means that every church has a dominant culture, one dominant culture that kind of rules over it and decides and make decision about the life of the church. So when you cross that threshold, become more intercultural intentionally, you need to think about, okay, how do we include other cultures who are in the church into making decisions about the life of the church? So we become a bit more inclusive, you know, how those cultures are represented in worship, how those cultures are represented in the style of preaching, or analogies that we use in our sermons. Are those analogies really speaking to all those cultures who probably don't have the shared history? So these are the challenges that are. So when you're crossing that threshold from a multicultural church to intercultural church, these are the intentional journey that you have to go through. So I hope that I've explained it well, but again, it's not easy, brother. You know that, you know, and that's where the reason I wanted to explain this rather than giving a definition is because that's where our FIEC's intercultural ministry have got three strands rather than definition. And I say it's a church that needs to think and act across economic divide, across generational divide, and across cultural and ethnic divide. So that's why explaining it much is much better rather than giving a definition.
So, from my understanding of what you've said,
multicultural might be the makeup of the pews, the people who are attending the church, the different ethnicities and cultures that are attending, and intercultural is how do we involve those different cultures within the life of the church, rather than just having them attending as being multicultural. When we're truly intercultural, everyone's involved and catered for. Is that kind of a
Yeah, so in your church, you might notice that you got this different ethnicity, cultures, and economic divides. They are coming to church before Sunday worship to listen to God's word, and they don't really interact. They don't do life together in the rest of the week. So for example, one example is that a Nigerian and a Chinese, what have they got in common? To share their life together inside and outside church, right? And how much they involve together in when the life is about crying together when you grieve, celebrating when you are happy and you're celebrating an occasion. How are you doing it together? Well, for kids it's a lot easy when you go to each other's birthday party. For what adults who are set in their ways is quite difficult. So that's where we need to understand that what is a culture? Culture is human way of do and don'ts as standards we have set for ourselves. Those standards don't really meet the holiness of God. So every culture has some aspects that need to be weighed against God's word. So no culture is perfect. So the challenge would be that how do we challenge those cultures that have got something that is not biblical? So how do we do that intelligently? How do we help them to integrate in each other's lives together? And that will shape your church in terms of bringing in different style of worship. Now, another example that I really like to tell about. Again, I mentioned about Nigerians and Chinese. Now, you might notice if you got Nigerian or mainly African heritage in your church, they often come across quite loud in their speech, in their worship, and that's the way God has designed them because they come from a hard environment where their vocal cords are designed to be an outside environment, which is often hot. And they are competing with other noises in the environment. And their vocal cords are designed to match up to that environment. So they are quite loud. And they're vibrant because it's a warm weather and they quite a lot of energy in them. And whereas you compare it with the Chinese, because the Chinese underground church, and by the nature of that being worship in secrecy, hiding from the state and state spying on them. They are naturally kind of they've got a mindset that okay, let's be very polite and be very silent in your prayer. So that's the way their mindset has developed. So when these two cultures come together in Britain, in the UK churches, so how do you help them to understand each other? Right? So again, it's not just one dominant culture has to adopt to other cultures, is every culture needs to think about each other and have to understand each other. So for the Chinese and Nigerian to understand why they are the way they are, God has shaped them when they were in their environment. And now they're coming across each other. And it's really exciting for us. It's happening in the UK, brother.
Well, but for I'd imagine over the last 50 years, up until more recently, a lot of we will have had churches, especially in the south of England, maybe in the northwest of England, that was more multicultural. But generally, the different ethnicities in the church were 2 and 3 generations into the UK. Many have assimilated through going to the same schools, the same universities, again, because it's middle class predominantly the church. A lot of different ethnicities will be working in similar fields professionally. So there's lots of Again, like even though there was difference in skin color within the church, when I went to churches, the actual culture was still quite homogeneous. There was just a difference in levels of melanoma rather than I remember being on a call with that was described as diverse, and it wasn't. I was the only odd one out. So there was people who were even born in foreign countries who had a better English accent than I did because of the education system.
I can't, that's what I say. I don't know what my accent is. I have never paid attention to that. But often I've come across second, third generation Indians or Pakistani, and they are more British in their accent and posh. And especially our brothers and sisters from London, So I'm from my home counties. Again, my as I mentioned about my wife, she's half Scottish, so she grew up in home counties. So she comes from a very, working class background. So she's her father was a working farmer on a farm, somebody else's estate. Before we got married, she moved to Bradford to work for a Christian organization there. And people in Bradford were like, "Wow, you're so posh." She was like, "Okay." She was like, often used to get these comments and stuff. But again, those are the differences. Those are probably not the visible differences, but there are differences. And because she's not like, she was from a working class background, working class family, and she was taken as like posh white British. So the visible, we don't notice those things until or unless it becomes very visible color differences. But those differences still, like, they existed before that. And again, I think our conversation where we started was that, when we met, was that, the white working class and the white middle class differences were never really noticeable and were not really paid much attention, that how much of cultural difference that exists there. That again is something that's where we say the cross economic divide. When you talk about cross economic divide, that church needs to think and act, that means those economic cultural differences, just because of your lifestyle is different, you got a background that is coming from a council state or something like that, so that you were brought up in a different culture. Yeah, one thing I think, don't want to go into much of the controversial, but I think one thing that really, in the British society, where there were those kind of a milestone moments, was Black Lives Matter movement in 2019. And that was the time when this whole thing about white privilege, this word was used quite a bit. And or just there were two people at the time. On one was on FIC podcast, our common friend, what I call Steve Neal. He made that point there on FIC podcast. Is like, well, people are talking about these white privileges. Well, it's difficult for us to go down in the council state and tell a single mom that you got a white privilege. And my wife said exactly the same thing. Is like, what white privilege I've got? So these are the things when we use these terminologies, and when our wider cultural movements drive these kind of ideologies, the church somehow and for some reason gets impacted by that. So we need to be careful that Bible has a mandate for the church, and when we mix it with to apply that mandate over the society which does not believe in Christ, and we have that expectation for them to act in a very biblical way, that is a bit dangerous. So we need to, as people of God, we need to think that what is the biblical mandate for the church, and basically work on that. And again, This is an intentional journey for every church in the UK now have to take. Wherever I've been traveling in last 2 years up and down the country, and wherever I'm going, people are telling that God's bringing these people from, we call it majority world. And that's another thing we need to explore as well. So God's bringing these people, and that's enriching the life of the British church. And it comes with its challenges. And that's where this ministry is really working and helping those churches. Now, when I say the term majority world, we also need to recognize is that the Britain or the UK is not a dominant Christian country anymore. The rest of the world has more Christians than Britain now. So it's what we call a reverse mission in action. So just to give you an example, sorry, brother, I can talk about this all day, so I don't know how long you got. An Indian pastor in Leicester approached me 2 months ago. That was the happiest moment in that week. We talked about a few hours and stuff, and he planted a church here as Indian businessman, and it's an interesting story if you got time for it to
Yeah,
go through, right?
by all means.
Right. So a friend from London City Mission asked me to, please do see this person because he needs some help with his setting a church or planting a church in Leicester. I'm like, oh, okay. Leicester's already got so many churches. What this guy's doing here? Right. So the story is, I met him, lovely guy, and his parents were in an evangelical church in Leicester about 40 years ago. And they were both Indians, and they went back to India to do some mission work and plant schools in poor communities in India. And that's where he grew up and born, and only language he knows is English because his mother just spoke English at home, and that's how he grew up. And the brother who referred me from London, they became friends in India. And that brother who is at London City Mission, he's from a Sikh background, so he was completely different religion. So he became a Christian through the ministry of that school, mission schools in India. And these two guys grew up together in their teenage together in India. So London City Mission invited this brother who was from Sikh background to work for London City Mission in London to reach out to Hindus and Sikhs. This is God's plan. So, and then anyway, so the brother who's now in Leicester, in last 3 years ago, he moved here. And then he still travels around and is involved in those mission schools in India. Involved with the support of some American churches. So he wanted to come back here to settle here. And some of quite a few of Indian businessmen got together that there's a need for a church. And the same churches from US is helping them to plant churches here in Leicester. Anyway, so they did that, and God has what they are saying, that they don't have an issue with money, that God has really blessed them, and they are all up to date. And they said to me, Justin, one thing we need help with. And I was like, oh, you got money, you got everything. What do you need the help with? Oh, we need help. How do we reach out to white British? So it's like, oh wow, okay, that's what God is doing. Just look at that. Right, so this is the way that God is moving across borders. Which sometimes we lose the picture of that. We got so much involved into what is happening in socially and politically in the country, but this is how God's moving, right? So we had a great conversation. So he really wants to get involved to get to know the other local churches and all that. That was the happiest moment for me, somebody saying that. So yeah, brother, this is the way God's working.
Yeah, well, it's funny that there's a guy I know from West Africa. He's been in the UK about 12 years, and he planted a church in Stockton, predominantly West African, different nations, Congo, some French speaking, some English speaking, Nigeria and Ghana. And some of the elders were getting frustrated with his outreach and suggested we need to get a projector and project the Jesus video off a big wall in the town centre. And he was like, just because that caused revival in Africa, it doesn't mean it'll work, and the people will just walk past, they'll ignore it. And so again, the similar thing, how this pastor from West Africa was encouraging and teaching the Nigerian and African migrants how to evangelize the West, in particularly the UK, and just saying, look, we can't bring the models of evangelism just because they were successful in Africa to the UK. We've got to think and develop different ways. And it seems that some of these churches that have been planted by migrants are more forward thinking and missional than the UK church.
Brother, it's what we call the revitalization with energy and passion, right? And that's what these guys are bringing, energy and passion, and to revitalize the British church. So I'm hearing all these stories from north, south, east, west. Just to say that I'm preaching in the last weekend of June down in Portsmouth, and a congregation that had like about 15 later age believers left struggling, and all of a sudden these Nigerian families with kids are turning up, and that's changing the life and bringing more energy into the church. And the leader was a friend of mine. He's really encouraged with that, and that's why the church, the older generation, they are really welcoming them. And it's like, wow, this is the way that interculture church is God's building in the UK. So again, it's not that simple. It needs to be managed. So if you know the early church, if you look at the in the book of Acts, I think chapter 6, the Hellenistic Jews were complaining about their widows being ignored, right? So these issues were there. So that needed managing for them. So they put together a team of people to take, okay, how we can do that? Let's delegate them and let's do it properly. But then they acknowledged that, okay, when different people come together, different ethnic background or different backgrounds and cultures, there will be some tensions. And that's why we need to be intentional, yes, intentional about the differences, right? We need to be intentional about, like, from a council state, a white working class person who's coming into a majority white middle class or a middle class background for that matter, because you can be a middle class Indian and middle class white as well. So if you're coming in there, there will be some differences and you need to understand each other.
And again, I think, sorry, 2 seconds, bruv. I think because we've had migration on a smaller scale. I know there was an influx after the Second World War when we were trying to recruit workers to fill the post of the jobs that we couldn't fill because of the amount of deaths in the Second World War and things like that. But it's been a steady flow since then, and a lot of people who have moved to the UK, particularly in the church. I know assimilation wasn't across the board, but generally within the church, the new ethnicities to the country would assimilate, and that kind of, especially in the south of England where everyone talks the same and in the same jobs, like we mentioned earlier, gives an understanding that possibly there isn't a culture within the church, that there's just one culture, and that's the Christian culture. And I've heard that said several times, especially when I was talking about the differences between working class and middle class, and people were reluctant to hear that. But now we've got a lot of first generation migrants coming to our churches. These cultural differences are a lot easier to see, bring a lot of encouragement, but also a lot of challenges. And we're hearing a lot more talk about intercultural and multicultural church. And how How do you think the church can best respond to that? Because I've seen it from two points of view. I've seen it from small white churches with an elderly congregation. Not all of them have been elderly, but like church has been the same way for generations, family after family, and then seeing the culture change rapidly has been like disconcerting for them, and there's been resistance. And then I've also seen it on the other side where it's been really welcomed and probably not being done as wisely as it could have been done, where all of a sudden it becomes almost chaotic and a free for all. And it's how do we manage these tensions as well as the blessings to see an intercultural church flourish rather than kind of spend its time like what we see in the New Testament, spending the time arguing over those that aren't being looked after.
My experience in the last few years, the churches that I know of, from Scotland to Bradford to Yorkshire to all of the places, and especially London. So London is unique in itself. So, but every church have got its own challenges. We can learn from each other's experiences. So let's talk about London. So London churches are naturally have kind of gone through this journey because the metropolitan nature of the city, because the cultures or ethnicity rub shoulders on underground and a lot more, so people are used to it. And they are naturally leading the way to becoming more multicultural and intercultural. But the rest of the country has been lagging behind. So there have been churches who have need revitalization just because of elderly congregation, and those congregations don't want to change, right? So there's been some challenges in some churches that I know, is that those congregations have said, no, this is the way we have always done, and this is the way we're going to keep on doing things, right? So the challenge for the leadership or the new leadership that wants to make those changes is that how slowly or how fast you go to bring in change without compromising the unity of the church. So this is a very, very important thing, is that yes, you want to keep people united, but either you use a sledgehammer or just that tapping hammer, whichever you want to use. But again, the unity of the church is very important, so keeping the people with you. So there's been, my church is like they're gradually making those steps and helping to understand each other. But the inner city churches, where you got more international students, Friends International Ministries, would have more chance to experience other cultures, would have a kind of a easy journey. But the churches who are in very rural areas of Britain, and the changes have are these kind of a cultural changes are happening around them, but for them, having that change in the life of the church is going to be a bit difficult. And for leadership, I would say that don't rush. God will work gradually. But again, some of the churches had to take very intentional steps. And one particular church, which is a really good FIC church up in Glasgow, our friend friends over there made a decision because they looked kind of anticipated that in about, if they keep on carrying the way the church has been, in 5 years' time, they won't have people in the church. So they had to make those radical steps to build those connections, because the demographic, the population, and the demographic around the church changed, and the church itself hasn't tried or didn't try to reach out to those people. So they had to think about how he can be welcoming to the church who are at the doorstep but are not coming in. So that led them to their journey to becoming more intercultural, and so that the church really reflect the life of those people who are coming in. So to say that everybody's welcome here. Now, again, this is sometime people we need to think about. I think previously I just mentioned that it's not that we are preaching a different gospel. We are preaching the same gospel differently. And also we need to keep in mind is that, Paul writing to Colossians has talked about it, and we need to be aware of this. And I think it's 2 Colossians chapter 2, verse 8. It says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through hollow and deceptive philosophy, which depends on human tradition and the elemental spiritual forces of this world, rather than on Christ." So we need to be aware of what is the human culture. We are not changing the gospel, but we are presenting the gospel that is palatable to different cultures. So yeah, so this is where you need to be aware and more intentional. And these are the challenges that we need to really think through. And it's not easy, brother. And that's why, yeah, you and I talking, we are learning from each other and helping each other.
Yeah. And again, I think there's a problem. You touched on it earlier about Black Lives Matter and how some political comments, political ideologies will take root in the church, and there'll be a, I often find there's a dominant political ideology, and that if there's a dominant culture, then it's no surprise there's going to be a dominant political ideology. So if the majority of the church are middle class white academic, and the majority of middle white class academic are left leaning or liberal, then that will kind of bring in presumptions and political biases that can be seen as biblical biases. So how do you guard against some of these ideologies that are mainstream from dictating how we do ministry in the church? What are some of the dangers of letting a political ideology dictate your mission, basically?
Yes, so this is great. This is something that we can spend the whole day now. Let's give you an example. A church in Nottingham I visited in January, and they are intentionally God brings so many people. It's become a church of about 500 or 600 people now. And the confessional prayer was led by a person, and it was just beautifully, praying to God, pleading to God about their needs and what's going on in the world and all that. And I was talking to afterwards to the prayer team, and I really said, it was really beautifully prayed, and thanks for doing that. And I was really impressed that there was. Often when I hear prayers there, you can judge from that how political leaning, which political leaning is coming through that prayer. And they said to me that they specifically have a prayer team, and they say to people that please keep the politics away from the prayer. And similarly, we need to keep that wider political what's happening in the UK or the world. We need to keep it away from our churches. We need to keep them away from that. Now, it's difficult. Now, we need to look at the scripture. Is that this is what I like to say, is that the Bible does not tell me who should I vote for, which party, left or right, which party should I vote for. Because the Bible was not written in a context where the democratic rights, people had democratic rights. Paul did not have a choice to vote for a conservative or a Labour, right? So Bible does not tell me, but there are principles that are guiding. And the church needs to hold those principles, looking after the needy, looking after the vulnerable people in the society. But when we start dictating those biblical principles to the society to tell them that you need to abide by those biblical principles, then that politics overlaps with the church. Now, yes, as a church, we need to speak truth to the power. We need to hold the political powers to account. We need to tell them when they are wrong, and the leadership needs to do that. But our leadership has not been great. I'm not talking about any specific denomination and stuff, but Christian leadership has not been great. Now that specifically, for me was as non-native British Pakistani heritage, for me to learn about the socio-political development of the post-World War has been quite an interesting learning. Is that the Methodist Church or Methodist ch Church movement was particularly for working class, right? And at the time, Labour Party was kind of together with that movement, with the Methodist Church. Those guys were really involved in the 1960s and 70s. But the church walked away from its mandate for the working class, for the people that it really represented and welcomed and worked in in the places, hard places. And the church walked away. Labour Party walked away when Tony Blair said that we don't do God in number 10, right? And then another thing is that, like, I often say about, like, we need to think about how socially this country has evolved. And in 90s, it is a 90s, a sociologist, Charles Murray from US, came to study the impact of globalization on British society. And he came in late 80s. I might be wrong, but I need to check the time. He came in late 80s to study that. And then he came back in late 90s. And late 90s, it was a New Labour in power. And he, after his observation and all that he made, and he said, basically, this the impact of globalization, because of that, and because of the reforms that to become a more welfare state and give incentives to single moms and to give incentives to poor, you have created an underclass which is caught up in a circle of poverty or circle of dependence on the state, right? So then the white working class was ignored by the church, ignored by the state, and left to be dependent on the state for their needs, and everybody moved on. It's like, yeah, that was like, wow, okay. Labour Party saying that Tony Blair, I'm not doing, we don't do God in number 10. Church moved on, and nobody cared about the white working class. But only until God brought these different people of different color in the church, and they've been such a blessing to the church. Then we started noticing, oh, there's cultural differences. But those cultural differences existed way before that.
I think with globalization, with the way that the UK government has gone subsequently, whether it be Labour or Conservative, I think basically there's two different names for the same beast. They tend to they're there for the elite rather than for the average person. And I'd go as far, and people have looked down at me, especially when we were looking at Black Lives Matter, and I was saying and white privilege about how there's elite privilege, and that it's the poor who are downtrodden regardless of their ethnicity. And I don't think it's as much an ethnic issue as a power problem, an abuse of power, and the victims are generally.
Absolutely.
And if you look at what's happened to the white working class, it's very similar to the African Americans in the 50s and 60s. How that similar kind of vein, where there was a book that I've been reading called Blame the Victim, where because the statistics showed that if you were a black man, you were more likely to be an absent father, to end up in jail, to be doing drugs, and it's And although that it was st statistically correct, that made it excusable for the media to portray that it was that black culture that was the problem, rather than the society's problem and the abuse of poverty. And if you and what this book does is it shows the correlation between white working class man and the black working class man equally struggling and finding themselves in the same position, especially when you're being encouraging mothers not to be with the fathers and to
It's system incentivizes that. So that's so yeah, again, when we talk about white working class, which has become really a buzzword these days because everybody wants to politically cash on that. But you can replace white with brown working class, you can use the black working class, because that's where the church really needs to act. Like, and it's not just the cultural difference, it's because of differences because of economic backgrounds. My friend in Portsmouth, he says that he's really thankful to God these Nigerians turn up on Sundays. They're probably 10 minutes, 15 minutes late, because I know that previous nights they were doing late night shifts. And to bring their kids along, if they come 10 minutes late, that's fine. But I'm happy they're turning up, right? And again, for the white working class, they will, you know more than me, brother, and they will bring those kind of issues. If they are turning up late, they are, we need to go and find out, what's happening in their lives. And that's where it's a two-way street. Everybody needs to understand these problems. An example that I really like from my past in Pakistan is I grew up grew up with American, the Evangelical Alliance Mission. Just to give you a background, they planted churches, schools, and hospitals in north of Pakistan. So my father was a pathologist as a locus partner there in 60s and 70s. So I grew up playing together with American brothers and sisters, and we had all these culture interactions, and we used to go to their households to eat pancakes, and they would come to eat parathas and all that stuff. But then along came in 70s was the Cold War thing, and which created a lot of refugees from Afghanistan that came into Pakistan. Now, Afghanis are very different people than Pakistanis. So, but one thing was good about Afghanis, they were very hardworking and they were very entrepreneurial spirit that they had. So, what happened was that obviously, as first generation immigrants, when they came in, they did took on labor jobs and local vendors who would sell things on the street. But that caused problem between or tension between the Pakistani working class and Afghani migrant working class, right? So instead of kind of helping them to deal with it, there were a whole lot of issues that created in there, right? So, but at the heart of it was the economic tension between that existed between them, right? And rather than people understanding that, it became an ethnic issue. So the issue was economic, but we over there was made as ethnic issue, and the whole lot of divisions and all sorts of stuff that happened. So from there, I say, like, okay, that's why I say it's just, it could be white working class, but if you wait, separate the white word and say it's brown working class, they're all the kind of the same problems that we have in life, because we are in a place where, which is sinful. We are all like, we are not immune from the sin of in our life, and those kind of economic background have got so much similarity, and they are not immune to those kind of problems that world poses at us. Now, saying that, the breakdown of marriages and all that stuff, it happens in super rich is more than.
But I think what we see is the difference. And I know that is encouraged, and I know the breakdown of marriage isn't restricted to the poor, but what isn't encouraged is young women to have children out of wedlock and have numerous children, and to men to have children without any responsibility towards them, and just think it's the woman's responsibility to upbraid them. So it's kind of been where there used to be a stigma, whether that be religious or social, whereas now there's no stigma. It's almost encouraged. It's made easy. And what I have noticed is when you see how Labour is thinks it's a good idea just to increase benefits for the poor, they think that's helpful. What the Nigerians have actually shown me within my local church is that not being allowed to access benefits is better for the poor than to, because the Nigerians have come, many of them, the wife or the husband will be doing a master's, and the partner's allowed to work, and they're having usually a full-time job and a part-time job over the weekend. And then also the one who's studying is also doing a part-time job. They've got an extended family that supports them financially, but also with childcare. And within 5 years of coming to the country, they're buying their own house.
And brother, the reason is that we come from a culture, what we say, very honor and shame based culture. I think you had that before here about 50 or 60 years ago, but you kind of put that the government given incentives have made you to let it go. There are good things about it, there are bad things about it, no doubt about honor and shame. I can tell you lots of stuff about that. But as Christians, we need to think about how my action glorified God's name and gave him honor, and how it brings shame to his name rather than my personal honor and shame. That's where the church framework should be. But in the society, yes, we come from a very strong honor-based culture where my family honor is very important to me. And that is something the British society has lost, because it's the paradigm has shifted
Can I
towards
just stop you there?
innocent
I
and
don't.
guilt. Go
Sorry,
on.
I disagree that we've lost it. I think it's been stolen from us, especially the
Is it?
working class. I'd
Yeah,
say
tell me. Yeah, I think
intentionally.
we had a chat about it. Tell for people.
Well, intentionally, but by successive governments and the elitists who were pro-globalisation, the working class were powerful in this country. We were needed for cannon fodder for colonialisation. It would be the working class who would be sent to war to risk their lives. They were the ones who built the nation through steelwork and coal mining and shipbuilding. And then also it was the working class who were also used to populate Australia, those poor kids who were taken from their parents and sent across the world to be adopted and fostered. So we've been kind of used as essential for the expansion of the kingdom until it got to a point where we became powerful with unions and things like that and expensive. And because the unions meant that we were working back in the 60s and 70s, we were getting a good wage for being working class. You could live quite comfortably. But we also affected politics and governments through our voting and our unions. And I think that's been deliberately eroded. And the de-industrialization not only meant we could buy cheaper products from abroad, but it kept the working class in the place and almost dumb and kind of a bit. It's like we've been put on antidepressants for the last 40 years. We're through the drug trade. I think that's why there's a definite impact on the drug trade. We could do a lot more to stop that, but it keeps a lot of people quiet.
No, I agree. So the globalization, the way it was sold to the West, has definitely failed the working class. You talk about the mining villages in Wales and stuff, that is obviously very prominent there. So just to give you a bit of background, so when I did my master's and took an internship, and I was commissioned by an organization in Bradford, a social enterprise. It was a partnership between that social enterprise in Bradford, Action for Business Limited, and a New Economic Foundation. They developed a tool called Local Multiplier 3. So the background thinking of that tool was that they were already feeling, these big organizations, the failure of globalization. So the so each multiple social enterprises around the country got into this partnership. So the study was to this tool would help you to measure your economic impact, and the organizations were encouraged to buy local. So local multiplier three means that each pound that you spend locally within your economy, buying from a local vendor, how far it goes to create an economic benefit for the local community or the local place. So we measured it three steps of that pound, how far it goes. So that's why it's called local multiplier three. Now, the idea that I want to get to is like, even in that was in 2009 and 2010. And even that time, these big economic organizations, they were feeling that this is not working out for the local communities and of the ex-industrial towns, specifically Bradford and those places. So they were like, oh, how we can, okay, we got this global competition now, we are a global market, but how do we encourage the local manufacturing and stuff? So there's a whole lot of tension was going on. So, but in the end, the victim were the historically the working class, right? So that's where was the failure was happening, and then we were hit with the economic crisis of 2009 and all that stuff. and it's just that I think now we are waking up to a world, and I think whatever we think about what's happening in geopolitical terms, we are waking up to a very new reality, and just because of the mistakes of the past, that, and as Christians, when we put our trust in politics, in economics, and all that stuff, we know that all those things will let us down. And where that's where the church needs to be a bit more stronger to say, and come along those people who are at the lower strata to say, no, we need to put our, you need to put your trust in God. Yes, you know, what God requires us to do is that, you know, all this abortions and all that stuff, the what this secular world is telling you is wrong. Right? And we need to come across the white working class, brown working class, all of those people to help them to understand things and bring them to God. And living under God has got, it's a different kingdom as compared to kingdom of this world. So yeah, brother, this is where those are the realities. We can't shy away. We should not shy away from those realities, what has happened in the country.
But this is where I think how a generous political understanding of where the white working class. So, for example, like the marches now with Tommy Robinson. If we had a Baptist Union superintendent come along to the church the other week and said, if you vote, basically, she was like, if you voted Brexit, or if you agree with that, we should stop the boats, then you're right, extreme right wing, right? Which you'll find that just alienated the majority of the church. But I think what the church needs to do is first understand and not vilify people who voted Brexit and understand why the working class feel so victimized. So I think it's understanding where the working class are, who are wanting to unite the kingdom and harker back to days gone by. It's not to do with racism. It's to do with we've had our identity, our families, our communities ripped apart. But then it's also offering them a better kingdom. And I think what we can do with that is when we look at the Nigerian families who were joining our churches, where there's mum and dad present, and nana and granddad and cousins, and the community. The reason the Nigerians survive when they come to Middlesbrough is because friends of friends of friends welcome them in, give them swear. The community is so strong.
Absolutely. And we those brothers and sisters, we need to learn from them. I was talking to a common friend of ours, and he sent me an amazing text. He said that two or three of families from his church have been over the weekend to Tommy Robinson's rally, and but they're really, really godly people. But at the same time, in the same church he's leading, have got these Nigerian and Ghanaian gods bringing them, and they are getting along perfectly fine. So yes, there would be tensions and stuff, but there will be political differences. But that's why I say that Bible does not tell me who should I vote for. Bible tells me to love my brothers and sisters, right? Like, Bible tells me to love my neighbor means that who's God put in your life, right? Regardless of what you ha what is happening, yes, there are tensions. There is a question about Islam that we need to answer. There are things that we need to tackle. Those are the tensions that have been created here. But again, as a church, how wisely we do that, right? This is where I would say a bit discouraged, or disappointed, let's say. The mission agencies in the UK or churches are not really seeing Britain as a mission field, right? And this is not just in words, it's a mind shift change, it's a paradigm shift. God is bringing all these people of very different religions, from around the world as well into the UK. So we need to more, put more effort and energy to reach out to them, and the historic unreached people ignored. You know, we need to do that. Yes, it's one thing is sending a white British person to Pakistan to reach Muslims, but we got Muslims here now. So what are we doing about that?
What, like you say, what we're doing about the Sikhs, what we're doing about the Hindus, what we're doing about
Exactly.
the atheistic white working class, and
Exactly, exactly, exactly.
and again, I think for me, looking at that, for me, the you mentioned that how the Labour and the Methodists departed from the roots. I think we've become with globalization as well. We're very individualistic in the churches. If we're so used to going off to university at 18, 19, and starting again, and living in a shared house where you don't really know anyone, there's and replacing community with a park run, and that the church meets on a Saturday and on a Wednesday, and then generally everyone's busy the rest of the week. And I think for me, if we want to see people investing in God's kingdom rather wanting to unite the British kingdom, we need to be offering them a family that they can be brought into, and a community that's being taken from them.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, that goes back to, you know, we said it's neither labor or conservative. You know, when the whole globalization and the liberalization of economy, and I think it was Maggie who said that get on your bike, basically, breaking down the communities, like you go where your job takes you. So there is no things that are communities. And specifically, I'm talking to some of our church planters who are planting churches in the new housing states, new developments. And those are the developments on the edge of the cities. And those guys are saying that there's no sense of community because they are just commuters. They just moved into this area, buy this new house because they got their job, they've moved in here. And they don't, there's no sense of belonging as a community. So doing a church in that part of or those kind of estates has got its own challenges because people are there for a 5 years contract, 2 years contract, or when the job moves, they move. So there's a whole lot of those challenges there as well. And again, we lost that community sense of belonging together to share our pain, sh to share our happiness together. We've lost that. And again, we are people of promise. We are people of promise for the future. So how far or how long are we gonna live with the hangover of the past? Living in the past, is it a good thing? That's what I really want to know. I don't know what your answer would be, brother. How do we do that?
How do we get over a hangover of the past? I think it's also the fear for the future, isn't it? And I think it's a case of making the most of the day, not hankering for the past or fearing for the future, but making the most of the day. And I think this country has irreversibly changed. Some of it's for the good, some of it's for the worse. But we want to see it change, don't we? We want to see it. We want to see it change. We want to see God's kingdom come. We want to see people saved and baptized in our churches
Absolutely.
grow.
Amen, brother. Yeah. So that's exactly. So rather than thinking about, okay, past was glorious, we need to take our country back to the past. God has presented us some new opportunities. And again, we were talking about Nigerian, Ghanaians, brothers and sister. There's one author, I forgot the name, but he wrote about that we've been praying about revival, but the revival has come to the UK probably in not the color that we were expecting it to be. So those people who are coming here, they are the one, like my brother in Leicester wants to reach out to the local now, because UK is a mission field.
Well, that's exactly so for me, we planted New Life Church 13 years ago. It's subsequently shut, sadly. But there's about 30 churches in that 13 years that didn't exist when New Life Church was planted. So I think there's five Indian churches and dozens of African churches. And somebody from our church, he was one of the West African church planters who planted the church about 15 years ago, who's a member of our church now. He was invited to go and speak at one of the Indian churches. So we're seeing the migrant pastors and church leaders practicing intercultural church and working together. And yeah, I just pray that we'll start seeing some of our
Absolutely, absolutely, brother.
indigenous guys working alongside the migrants for the sake of God's
Absolutely,
kingdom.
and there are churches. So in next 1 month, the June is there's hardly, I think there's 1 week weekend I'm home, but the rest of the weekends I'm traveling, visiting those churches. There's the new buildings, churches moving into bigger buildings. And this whole thing about that, I think in last couple of months, we've been quite discouraged in terms of this quiet revival thing. That was it. There was a quiet revival. No, there's not. Oh no, this was miscounted. Okay, I think the mistake that we make is that we get too much caught up in numbers and figures and statistics and kind of a thing. I don't think so. God is interested in number in terms of, like, stuff, but God is interested in young people in different communities and different generations to different economic backgrounds. And I can see that, like, traveling around, I can see that the number of people God's bringing in to the churches is increasing massively. Now, do we need a study to kind of just to satisfy my heart to say, oh yeah, feel a bit of pride about it? I don't need that. I can see that God is at work. One of our churches reported that a guy from a certain background in terms of, like, just turned up at church full of tattoos. So they found out that he's a tattoo artist. Who's got this high street shop, right? So, but he wanted to know Christ. So that's great. He got baptized and stuff, and how long he brought was more people with tattoos. So these are the things, is that is the church ready to disciple people like that? This is where I don't see, there is a bit of gap here. And that's where we're trying to work and help the churches, like, okay, how are you gonna do this? Because there's a cultural difference. A person with who's a tattoo artist who rubs shoulders with people, probably you don't want to know them, but there's an opportunity here. So he's bringing more people like the himself. And then how are you gonna disciple those people? Right? Our objective is to disciple them to for them to be more like Christ, not to be more like us, right? And we often is like, okay, how can we make them more working from working class to more middle class?
But the problem isn't just that. The problem is if we want to disciple people to become more like Christ, We need to be doing that ourselves, and I think that's the hardest bit.
Yeah.
And and if we're not willing to put the effort in to reflect Christ in how we welcome outsiders and people who are different to us, then
Yeah.
we're, and I think that's a problem with all of us. We pray for revival, but the reality means it's going to be tough.
It's going to be tough. And again, another danger which I'm seeing in after a few conversations that I'm having, and then this is where as church leaders and the ministry leaders, we really need to be careful, is that how much of this a wider social environment that we are currently living, how much of that impact of that we absorb into the life of the churches. We really need to be careful on that. Now, for example, there is this kind of anti-immigrant kind of a vibe in the wider country, socially and politically. Now, the conversation is helping, okay, some church leaders in a way that the conversation is about, okay, so in future, we're probably going to have less of immigrants coming in. So to become more multicultural and intercultural church successfully, why don't we just focus on second and third generation of immigrants? As if God's going to stop moving the people around the world. In my experience, I've traveled around the world from South Korea to all the Pakistan and other places. People are moving at much faster pace than ever before. We are flying a lot more. People gonna keep on moving around. God is at move, and God moves through people. So thinking that, okay, the first generation gonna stop, I think it's a misguided understanding here. So that's where that impact of the wider political and social coming into church, we just need to be careful about that.
Yeah. Again, just as you were talking there, just I went and met a pastor, asked me to go and meet him. He's working, he's ministering to a number of working class men in a tough council estate, and we went down to meet in the pub, and we were chatting. One of the guys said he's so fed up of immigration that he's bought a flat in Dubai. And then he said, "Does that sound hypocritical?" Brilliant. So
And
there's some fun things.
oh yeah, well, the Dubai is the most diverse place, and actually the way they manage their multiculturalism, the Dubai and or UAE and those Middle Eastern countries which are economically very strong, and the way they manage their labor power and the working class, people over there, they get upskilled and then they move across to the Western world because there's more kind of a deficit of highly skilled people in NHS and all that. So they are kind of a training ground for the Western nations. So that's what I mean is that whenever there's need, there is a supply. So that's how it's working. That's how people are moving, and that's not going to stop. But boy, that is quite an interesting
It's funny,
but
but again,
again,
I think just the sell, and again, for me, speaking to these men, I don't think the issue was immigration. It was illegal immigration and people working for less than minimum wage, and so a lot of the guys that I know who were picketing, just this was pre and during Brexit against the Polish workers, they weren't saying we don't want the Polish workers here. They were saying if they're going to be here, they
Sorry, I lost your.
need to be on the. So there was just coming to labour. So again, it was for a fair wage they were arguing, but that media twisted it to be it was anti-Polish rather than, hang on, we want to be working for a fair wage. So again, I think there's also looking at there's such a. It's quite divisive. People have got genuine concerns, and obviously there's people who are generally racist as well, isn't there? But there's always like one extreme, and then there's a lot of people in the middle as well that are generally fearful. And rather than vilifying either side, it's trying to find the common ground and reassuring them of
So
the.
interesting. I don't know if you've read the government's new social impact or social cohesion policy. A couple of days before it was launched, or the couple of days after it was launched, I was part of a group of national leaders to meet the faith minister, if Meata Fanbula, who's now resigned from Keir Starmer's cabinet. I think she was the first one to resign to show his kind of a not really liking anymore. That policy has that they launched, because my background is like the previous policy after 2001's riots in Bradford and those industrial towns and stuff is exactly the same, is not much different. But the key element in that is worth noticing, and the government is noticing that, things that we were talking about, the different ethnicities and the tension, economic tension between them. And the government has this time acknowledged that we have become a low trust society, right? So what does that mean? So how the government's going to do social engineering, and that is what this report is about, right? And that's where I was, I think I was quite vocal. I hope I wasn't too rude towards the minister. It was a good discussion, but the thing is that I don't see a consistency of policy, because the government don't stay for that long. And again, putting our trust in the kingdom of this world is not wise for us, right? And but we do need to understand that the point that we are a low trust society, and thinking of how we got here, right? How come we, in living in the same society, don't trust each other? Because we don't have a shared denominator. But in the church, we do. That's Christ, right? So that's where the church is different. The church needs to be a representative, a reflection of future, of Revelation 7:9 or Revelation 5:9, I would say, which is just amazing. Because Lamb of God coming, that cares about all nations and all tribes. So that's what we need to show to the world, because we got a shared denominator, that is Christ, and that we want to show it to the world, and we want to show the light of Christ. But yeah, brother, these are the challenges. But again, talking again, you mentioned about the person moving to Dubai, and the way those guys are managing the trust between different cultures, and because they are far more multicultural than Britain is, but they are managing it. But they are managing it not the way that we would like our society to be managed, because they manage it through facial recognition cameras, and they control the crimes. You can't chew gum on their metro. You can't use water bottles for drinking water in their metros and stuff like that, because you get caught through facial recognition. So crime's very low. You might have heard that people of UAE and Dubai bragging about it. We got so less crime, because that's how they manage it. That's how they manage the trust. So we are heading that way as a society. Because you might have noticed the King's speech, that this government brought to bring back the idea of the facial recognition cameras, which already been used, I think, in Essex and some other councils. So that's how they want to bring this society, because as by social engineering, as a high trust society. But I don't know how far we're going to go with that. But the question is, as Christian, what will be our role? What should be our role in this kind of environment where we are in a very low trust society?
Point them to the person we can trust.
Exactly. That's what it means. That's the one. That's the one who died for everybody, brother.
Awesome. I could speak all day with you, Justin. I really appreciate your time, and I appreciate your role within the FIEC, and I'm always excited to hear about what's happening. But Yeah, we'll have to chat again at some point, but
Absolutely. But we are seeing each other, aren't we, in person next month?
yeah, next month, yeah, that'll be good to catch up, yeah, at
Yeah.
the weekender.
Looking
So
forward to that, brother.
yeah, oh, wonderful. Oh, well, thanks
Yeah.
anyway for joining me on the In Context podcast.
Thank you. God bless. Bye.